The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Financial technology, or fintech, is one of the fastest growing industries in the world today, with New York, London, Tel Aviv, Edinburgh, Singapore, Moscow, and other major cities all vying for a piece of the action. Welcome to Breaking Banks, the first dedicated radio show that focuses on how this new boom is changing everything from the way we bank to the very concept of money itself. Now, here's your host, Brett King.
Hey guys, welcome back to Breaking Banks. I tell you guys, it was down to the wire today to get into the studio. I had to get a train out from Connecticut where my family is, and the first train was cancelled, the second train was 20 minutes late, the third train I finally got and had to run to the office, just made it. Glad I made it. Yeah, live from New York, some news this week. I'm sure you guys saw the news that we had a purchase of SunGard, $9 billion this week, and InvestNet. Purchased Yodlee or acquired Yodlee. It sounded more like an M&A to me, but we might get Mitch in the second segment to talk a little bit about that deal. Yodlee for $590 million. But of course, the big news earlier in the week was Google creating Alphabet. So this was their new parent company. And if you do get a chance, have a look at the Google blog to the announcement made by Larry on the new structure. Really great corporate comms. If you haven't read his blog, it's interesting. There is some cynicism that the name Alphabet was chosen because it comes before Apple. I don't know if that applies anymore. It's sort of like it used to apply when you had phone books, but does it apply now? We're in the world of search. Yeah. Anyway, the other news, of course, was BlackBerry is partnering with PayPal. They just won't die, those guys at BlackBerry, will they? And then in Bitcoin news, Denmark's Coinify acquired the Dutch CoinZone, and this is now a pan-European provider of Bitcoin to fiat processing. So that's a pretty big deal for EU. We have an EU-wide Bitcoin exchange now, which is codified, so this is good. So there's a few bits and pieces for you guys. There might be some other stuff I bring up during the show as well. We are going to continue our series on the Internet of Everything for the first segment today, and we have back on the show with us. I'd like to invite Paul Jamieson, the Managing Director of Global Industry at Cisco, to join us again. Paul, welcome back to Breaking Banks on behalf of Cisco.
Thank you, Brett. Enjoy it. Thank you.
And also joining us is Jerry Silver, the Research Director for IDC Financial Insights. Jerry, welcome.
Thank you, Brett, for having me.
So let's kick off first with some of the latest research in terms of some of the trends we're seeing. The ABA put out their report this week about mobile and, channel migration. Mobile continues to rapidly grow, fastest growing channel in terms of regular bank interaction. And surprise, surprise, branch and telephone are down. Once again, continuing their ongoing declining trend since 2008. Nothing new there. But are we seeing some other trends emerge in respect to overall behavior? So, I don't know, Jerry, do you want to jump in first?
Sure, yeah. And I think this is a trend that's happening across the board. I know Paul and I have had discussions in the past about the old fuddy-duddies like me versus the younger generations like maybe my 17-year-old daughter. But we did some consumer surveys in the springtime of this year where we asked about generic technology decisions. How do they use technology? How do they how do they see technology? And one of the really interesting findings was when we look at three different age segments, the over 55 crowd, which I will soon be in, the 35 to 55 crowd, and then everyone under 35, the extent to which they use technology
and here and how they buy and everything else. So we ask questions about how often do you buy them, why do you buy them, does it make you more productive and efficient, does it let you connect with other people and experiences. As you go across those three age segments, the number of people that agree with those statements get larger and larger and larger. As an example, being able to access people, experiences, being able to share things like reviews becomes very, very important to the under 35, not so much important to the over 55, as an example. So we think this is definitely insight into a trend that's just going to continue. People are going to get more and more reliant on technology, and they're going to want to use technology more and more within their personal lives, not just financial services.
Absolutely. So with this increasing use of technology, let me ask you this question then, and this, Paul, I'll put this to you. You know, as we start to, you know, it's not just now smartphones that we're using. You know, when we post pictures from our cameras, we have geolocation data shared. We're wearing sensors on our wrist that capture our heart rate. The sort of, you know, Cisco's right at the heart of this Internet of Everything stuff. But with all this data that's coming and gathering this information, how's that going to change the way we experience things like banking?
Well, you know, similar to Jerry, we had some research we executed in the November timeframe globally, and actually had asked you and Jerry and a few others your point of view on it. It's kind of the bottom line is you have more data being collected, and there's a more ability for whoever the financial institution is to deliver what the consumers want. Interesting, in our latest survey, the actual gap between the more classic bank and what we'll call the evolving digital consumer is actually increasing according to our data. And what it's pointing out is that the banks have the ability to collect this information and help deliver what many of the consumers value the most, which is a very personalized experience that's convenient to them. We all know transactions are becoming automated self-service. I think McKinsey says 95% will be self-service in 5 years. So the ability to collect this information and make things more personalized and more convenient, which were the two highest ranked factors in our research, is out there. Also, the ability to overcome what would be the biggest concern, which is security. So using different approaches, maybe more secure approaches towards payments, maybe more effective approaches towards identity management, will become much more available. And the reality is, we've talked about the changing banking landscape, at least since the three of us have been in the industry. The reality is we're seeing some enormous changes right now. And the consumers are driving it based on their behavioral requests.
I'm a little unsure about this security thing with millennials, you know, with the younger generation. I think they're more concerned about utility. I think if utility works, the stuff works, and you know their information doesn't get stolen or compromised, I think they're okay with it. I don't see them. I don't see any signs that they're not adopting technology because they have security concerns.
I think you're spot on, actually. Our data tells a very interesting story. You ask a baby boomer or silver, have you ever experienced financial hardship due to your banking relationship in the form of fraud or anything security related? And they will say no. And then you say, do you trust them in this electronic landscape? And they will say no. Which is interesting. They've never experienced the pain, yet they'll say no. You ask the same of millennials, and they'll say, of course they trust that situation. They live in the cloud. So they've really never been burnt, and they don't see a reason to not trust something where they haven't been burnt. So completely agree with you on that point of view around, and it actually extends beyond millennials, probably to that under 35-year-old grouping from the data we have.
You know, so, it's funny. I have to wonder whether that's being driven by being jaded or being hardened, depending on your perspective, to the events happening. I mean, you know, for a millennial or for a boomer like me, data breach, you know, massive data breach where I have to go through the trouble of having a card reissued, that's brand new to me, whereas the millennials see more and more of that. Just anecdotally, Target got hit with the data breach, it took their customers months to come back, to trust that brand again and come back and start shopping again. Fast forward, 9 months later when Home Depot was hit, it was weeks and not months. Same consumer base, and yet it took less time for them to come back and say, well, you know what, the last time this happened to me, I got a new card, it was, you know, a bit of a pain, but ultimately I was made whole, so this is no big deal, I've seen this before. And I'm wondering whether that's what makes the difference between the millennials who, you know, see headlines every day. It's not something new to them. They realize what the risks are, but being the value, Brett, as you say, they're getting the utility out of this, so they're willing to put up with that.
It desensitizes the risk because as long as they don't lose their utility, then they're okay.
Yep.
So, listen, what about then in respect to all this data, you know, that's flying around? Obviously, we're starting to get a lot more nuances here in respect to things like behavior and where real risks are inherent. And part of the problem is that, you know, we have a credit scoring system in the United States, and I know this show goes out to 70 countries, so not everyone has credit rating systems like we do in the U.S., but it's become more of a system which punishes you when you default on credit rather than actually giving people access to credit when they haven't had it before. So how is this new data around behavior going to enable access to more financial services for people that don't, for example, have a credit score?
Well, I do believe you're going to see alternatives to the classic credit checking that takes place today. As you said, it's designed as a punishment, largely focused on protecting from default of loans, and really isn't oriented towards today's, you know, business or consumer models. The data you have out there now, as we all know, banks have historically housed data based on transactions. So, you know, whether your deposit or loan systems or your customer information file, you capture the data only when a transaction takes place, and it was always siloed. The people that you could put it together for and throw it out to were the agencies that were credit scoring. Now we actually have the ability to look at behavior for the first time, due largely to mobile, and the focus is on multi-channel integration, you know, omni-channel interaction type of activity. And you can actually see behaviors both with your bank and outside of your bank that can give you a much more accurate picture as to the risk, and maybe I'll go to where we really believe it's going to take place, the reward. So proactively communicating to capture greater wallet share with offers and other enticing efforts to provide better value to your consumer versus just punishing them. And, you know, one would argue the data's always been out there, but the data structures weren't there and they weren't available to be used. That's changing. That's changing very quickly.
This is one of the most fascinating areas of all of this data coming in from every device, whether it's your phone or your Fitbit or your watch. The fact that the institution can now use the data to create or to make other decisions. I've always said that besides the supermarket, no one knows more about my personal life than my bank does. Now, I can envision a future where the bank is making a credit decision or giving me a credit score on standby, if you will, should I ever come in or call or whatever looking for a credit line, based on, you know, how often does Jerry go out to dinner? What does that ratio of paying for meals out have to say about his disposable income? God forbid that kind of information get to, you know, my healthcare provider, where now they're looking at, you know, how often do Paul and Jerry go out for a whiskey?
Uh-oh, we're in trouble.
Exactly. But so very interesting.
The healthcare provider gives you incentive, to not go out for whiskey has a positive financial impact as well, then that's okay. You know, if they, for example, say, look, if you reduce your whiskey drinking habit, we'll reduce your premium, then that's
absolutely
a fair trade, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's what some of the teenage insurance companies are doing by attaching the fob, using the quote-unquote Internet of Everything to incent a behavior where you sign a contract, parent, child, and insurer, and you set up a contract that says if this behavior is positive, you know, you don't go past the speed limit, you don't go into certain neighborhoods, you don't stay out past 11, then your premium goes down. If you change your behavior and it's a negative behavior, then your premium goes up. And there's actually getting to be a very high acceptance of that because it's kind of an agreed upon contract that's established based on that behavior. Back to the data side. If we assume transactions are going to be automated, so you take direct deposit of 20 years ago and now it's completely invisible to all parties, imagine if even new account opening gets to that level of transactions just being seamless. All you have left is interactions and advice. And I really think that's the more interesting area for all this information. Less about, you know, the punishment related to credit, more about looking at your sources and uses of funds down to an individual level and using this automation, either using agents or making humans available in a different way, not driving down, not taking time off and driving down to the branch, but having someone who really knows you, advise you. I think there's huge opportunity there. And whether that thing that knows you is a computer recommending something on the fly, or whether it's for a bigger life decision like a mortgage or some investments, whether it's an individual available to you, you know, at halftime during the football game, and you dial them up and you're looking at them face to face as if you're sitting in the office, and they're giving you very personalized advice based on your behavior and your needs. That opportunity is right at the doorstep.
So we are already having discussions with institutions about how things like robo advisors, virtual advisors, whether it's a mortgage analyst or whoever, about how cognitive systems and augmented reality are going to affect their internal staff. Certainly it will reduce the need for branch and contact center people, but of the remaining human staff, will they need to be, you know, wiser, they'd be higher paid because they're advising at a higher level. They're actually bringing more value, albeit fewer of them, because of all of this technology.
But, you know, this is really key, is with all this automation, there's simplification of the experience, such that we don't need to see humans. And in fact, it's not only going to be more efficient, it's going to be safer for us. We had Jumia on the show recently explaining that with their facial recognition and document capture technology they have, so you can photograph your driver's license, for example, that it's 400% safer than a human in a branch verifying identity, as an example, right? So, there's a lot of stuff that's going to drive us towards this automation. My question is, as this all happens and experiences become sort of more integrated, are we going to need humans to advise us in the process at all? This is a big topic. We could talk about this for 20 minutes. We've only got a minute before the break, unfortunately. But for millennials, just I guess maybe finish off with this question, Jerry. Do millennials want advice, or do they just want solutions, stuff to happen?
No, they definitely, if you look at the sharing that's happening today between the millennials, and again, I'll use my daughter as an example, they share everything all the time. So I think they want advice. It's just going to be in a completely different than banks are used to giving it.
Yeah, now that's a good answer. All right. Well, listen, Paul Jamison, Managing Director of Global Industries at Cisco. Paul, where can we find out about Cisco's Internet of Everything business line?
Yeah, you can just come to cisco.com. It's right smack on our front homepage, and we have a lot of other interactive ways to connect with us. So just start there, and it works.
Fantastic. And Jerry, where can we find that report on millennials?
So IDC Financial Insights, the website is idc-fi.com, and you'll find it right there.
All right, gents. Well, thanks for joining the show on Breaking Banks today. We're just going to have a quick break, and we'll be right back with Mircea and Luke.
Mm-hmm. It's been probably the best thing we've ever done, without a doubt.
In 2011, Duane Blomstrom and Maniga headed to the first Finovate in Europe.
We were a very small company back then, six people. We had decided that we're going to actually demo, which was a big step for a small company at that time.
After winning Best of Show, they grew to be a European market leader in personal financial management.
Pipeline essentially exploded as a result of this. It essentially put us on the map.
So why do they keep going back to Finovate?
It keeps us honest innovation-wise.
Register today for Finovate Spring 2015 in San Jose on May 12th and 13th and experience future fintech first.
When you're looking for the right place to eat, there's an app for that. When you need directions getting there, there's an app for that. And if you're trying to make a healthy choice, there's an app for that. But what about an app that tells you how you're doing with your money? Now, there's an app for that. It's called Moovin, a free app and debit account that automatically tracks your spending. You get real-time feedback with every purchase you make and a debit account with no overdraft or monthly fees. So if you want to stay on track with your money, download the Moovin app for free on iPhone or Android and check out Moovin.com. That's M-O-V-E-N.com.
Today, make that long overdue call to your bank and thank them. Thank them for a checking account, one that has a minimum balance and penalties for going below it. Thank them for a savings account, one that has almost no interest and charges statement fees to let you know it. Most of all, thank them for overdraft fees and all those other fees you never even knew existed. Thank them today. Why? Because the future of banking is here, and it's not just what you want, it's what you deserve. Moovin is a free app and debit card with no overdraft, ATM, or monthly fees. Best of all, you get an instant receipt every time you make a purchase and daily feedback on your spending so you can always be on top of your money. So make that call to your bank and say thanks, but no thanks. And when you're done, download the free app and get Moovin today.
The successful businesses of today do everything they can to meet the needs of their customers. But outdated IT systems mean that banks often struggle to offer the same level of personalized service. SunTech is working with some of the world's leading banks to help them provide the products, offers, and services that their customers need and want. Visit suntechgroup.com to find out more. That's suntechgroup.com.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Breaking Banks featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag #BreakingBanks. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to Breaking Banks. We have back in the studio with us Dr. Mircea Mihaescu. I don't know if I pronounced your surname correctly, Mircea, but was that close enough?
Good enough. Thank you.
I don't want it to be good enough. I wanted to get it right. But you can train me offline. And Luke Bergelman, who's the CEO of NG Data. Welcome to into the studio, Luke.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Welcome to New York.
Yeah.
For those of you that know Peter Vanderaura, who's been on the show quite a few times actually, he's pals with Luke, known Luke for many years and introduced us, so we're glad to have him on the show. We on the rumor mill, the rumor is that the iPhone 6S is going to be out in September. We have not had the invitations go out yet, but I look forward to the time. Hey, did you listen to the show last week?
No, not last week. Yeah,
I did an Arnold Schwarzenegger impression. Did you know that?
Yeah, so that's something that now I have to listen to it. Yeah.
So what I was going to say is that when we hear about the iPhone and it's no longer a rumor, I can say it's not a rumor. Sorry. You have to know Arnie to know that, but anyway. Luke, NG Data, you guys tell us about NG Data, because we're talking a lot about Internet of Things and data, so tell us about what NG Data does.
Yeah, so with NG Data, we're helping banks, that's most of our customers actually, to work with big data and get more out of it. So try to avoid hiring tons of data scientists. So we're trying to put a lot of automation in big data analytics and basically taking it to the next level so that they can focus on how to change the customer experience with that.
Okay, so how big's your team? Where are you based?
I'm based in New York. The company started 3 years ago in 2012 in Europe, and we have now two offices in the U.S. as well, so New York and San Francisco.
Okay. What's the size of your team?
About 70 people now.
Wow, that's pretty pretty serious. So, you're primarily in the services business, or
actually our key thing is developing the software for them.
Right.
So, we started having a bunch of partners that implement our software.
Okay, so we talked a lot about these data profiles and Internet of Things capturing a lot of data. So what's your view as to sort of the risk-reward of this? You know, for consumers listening, for example, on the AM band out in New York here, should they be worried about their smartwatch and what data it's sending back to Apple or Google?
No, I don't think so. It is actually important there. So you definitely see a trend, right? I think that if you can improve the experience, if you get the things that you want, you're happy to share more information, I guess. So, and that's, to me, is key. I would worry more about companies hiring hundreds of people analyzing data and trying to find things than computers optimizing things for you as an individual.
Yeah, fair enough. So in terms of this, you've got this theory that you guys build into data profiling around, or data in terms of DNA profiles.
Yeah.
But is this a sort of heuristic data profiling of individuals, or what is this DNA profiling in data?
Yeah, so I think that's the core thing of what we do. I hear a lot about always two words when it comes to big data. People talk about insights and personalization. To me, it's twice the wrong thing, because I think you need to talk about impact in the first place and then about relevancy for the consumer.
Yeah.
So, and you can only create an impact if you move insights to the next level, and that's basically interacting with an individual. So you have to know the person. And I think the key thing is it's not necessarily all the models and profiling, because if a bank has 10 million customers and they have 25 different profiles, that means as an individual, you're in a bucket with 400,000 other people, right? So the difference lies in what we call weak signals, and that's everything to do with behavior, with context of all these things. And if you do that on an individual level and you automate those processes, that allows you to become relevant, because personalization, you're nothing with a nice email that has your name right and then has 200 products to offer you if you get it every day. You just want one thing when you really need it.
Right.
So timing is in context of when and where you get things is more important, I think.
So, you know, do you see that we're getting more abilities to predict that? For example, you know, if I like to shop at a certain type of grocery store, and you know, by nature of the fact that if I go to this grocery store on this day, I might get a deal.
Yeah.
You know, are we able to predict that with enough accuracy that we can start to do that sort of you know, messaging?
Well, I think it's even a step further. You have that much information now that you don't even have to predict it anymore.
Right.
So the data is there, and that's kind of the core philosophy of Google, is like data is 10 times more powerful than any predictive algorithm you can develop. So if you have all that information, you can walk by a store and it can tell you like this, there's an interesting promotion now for you.
Yeah, but only if it knows you're interested. Because we don't want just a broadcast thing, right? You know, an 80-year-old woman walks past a surf shop and gets an ad for a surfboard. That's not going
to
work.
Exactly. So that's why you have to know the individual's interest. And
okay. So, you know, is this, in terms of the nuances here, is this about collecting other publicly available data and overlaying that on your sort of unique mobile data or your unique smartwatch data? You know, how many sources of data do you guys typically look at when you sort of pull together a DNA profile of someone?
Yeah. So actually, you would say about 10 to 15, but you would be surprised when a bank just collects has about 10 different digital touch points today. When you just are able to bring that together at one point, how smart you already are.
Because banks don't do that, do they?
They try it for 20 years, but they still can't do it. Yeah.
Yeah, well, primarily because all their data is on different servers in different exactly. departments.
Yeah.
And they don't share data with each other.
No.
Yeah. I used to work with HSBC in Asia. And I remember getting a call. So if you guys have read my book, Bank 2.0, you would have heard this story, so forgive me for repeating it. But I had got sent a pre-approved offer for a platinum Visa card. And so then the Visa card department rings me up one day, and I had a gold Visa card. And they rang me up to say that there'd been a security issue and they're going to have to reissue me with a new card. And I'm like, that's fine. Okay, so reissue me a new card. But why don't you reissue me the platinum credit card, because you said I'm pre-approved for that. And they said, I'm sorry, sir, that's a different department. Yeah. We wouldn't even know who to talk to exactly. to get that to happen. Yeah. I mean, that's how, you know, for product lines, that's how problematic the silos are in banking. So is that problem exist from a data perspective as well?
It does, yeah. It does on two levels. It does on the technology level because it's on different systems and different formats and uses different IDs and all that stuff. But it does also in an organization. So there's a lot of politics that in the way of getting these information together as well.
So is one of the ways to pull this data out investing in relationships with fintechs who don't have those constraints, do you think?
I think there's that's a good way forward. I believe that banks to be successful, there's a bunch of things that has to do with strategy. So everybody starts to understand that they will have to be embedded in tons of other services, right? But even to do
but it's
that,
not just banks. I mean, retail businesses, transport companies, et cetera, et cetera. They're all going to have the same approach.
Yeah, every sort of utility that we use in bank is a commodity utility,
right.
And as telecoms, as energy or something, they have. You buy a car and you get your insurance and then your loans with it.
Yeah. Right?
So if you don't get your information together for that individual, you won't be able to process it in real time when it needs to happen. And the first one that is able to do that is going to be very successful.
Yeah. So, Mircea, being that you are a globally recognized investor in the fintech space, venture capitalist, which I think these days it doesn't have the negative connotations it used to have.
I don't know. As long as you don't use the word vulture, I think venture is fine. Yeah.
Or capitalist. In respect to now, for organizations like banks who are troubled by these data silos and organizational inefficiencies and innovate quite slowly. Sometimes taking years. Like when I remember when I was on Bloomberg and CNBC talking about the book early, which was back when I launched Bank 2.0, it was 2010. That was 3 years after Apple had launched the iPhone. And at that time, only 3% of US banks had a mobile app, right? So this is sort of indicative of the speed at which, traditional organizations respond to the sort of innovative technologies we're seeing. But what role do fintechs have to play in pushing forward improvements in this stuff, Mircea?
Yeah, so I think that fintechs in the past 3, 4, 5 years, they've been able to show traditional banks that there is something that can be gained from technology, from getting the latest technology, especially mobile, but also big data and cloud. For many years, big banks have considered themselves as the bastion of conservatism, so you don't change things, or you change very slowly. Banks have been the original fintechs. Yeah, many technology companies made their fortunes by selling to big banks. Things have been steady for the past 5-10 years, and fintech startups, they are showing that things can change, that there is another or new better ways of dealing with transactions, new better ways of dealing with loans and credit, with wealth management, and the valuations and the number of customers that we see, they are proving the point. So banks are waking up. Banks are seeing this as something that they need to do. I mean, you had a great contribution to the books that you have written and published, Brett. Many executives at key banks have read your books, and they talk with you, and they talk with consultants that tell them what to do and how to do things. But it's still very slow, because by definition, large institutions don't move quickly. And if you don't move quickly, by the time you are done with your planning, with your 3 year strategy, with your 3 years budgeting, the earth has moved underneath your feet already.
Yeah. So what are some of the practical challenges in a bank mobilizing and working with a, you know, a fintech solutions provider or a fintech startup that has got some revolutionary new technology?
The number one step that a bank needs, or a large bank, or I would say any bank needs to get past, is that you cannot do everything yourself.
Yeah.
There are many smart people at banks and very well qualified departments that can build those things. It's just that the processes inside large banks, inside large organizations, they are not conducive to make to rapid changes. So by recognizing that fact and recognizing that fintechs, by definition, being small and doing things faster, are bringing the latest ideas and technologies to market at a different pace, that's the internal recognition that the bank needs to absorb, to conceptualize. And after that, move to the next step, which is how do you work with them? Many banks, and I've worked for large banks, and I've started companies, and I've invested in a lot of companies. The number one obstacle when you get in front of the bank, after you convince the executive in charge that the bank should use your technology, should work with you, is now you get to the procurement team.
Right.
And the procurement team, they have established procedures. They are well-versed in negotiating long-term multi-million dollar deals with IBM and Oracle. And they start by moving at a different pace. They start by, oh, but we need to negotiate the price down, without realizing that if the price goes down, the startup will go out of business. So the startup cannot subsidize the bank. It should be the other way around. They ask for all the paperwork, which is normal for a large publicly traded software company, but not for a 30 people company in Brooklyn.
That's really insightful, Mircea. That's you know, I think that mirrors our own experience with Moovin, is that we've had we might be doing a 6 week engagement and spend 4 weeks doing legal with procurement beforehand. Yeah. It just doesn't make any sense. It's not an efficient use of our time as a startup to spend burn four months on legal. You know, that's not our specialization. We're not good at that stuff. We're good at building stuff. So let us build it. Luke, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, well, I experienced more or less the same thing. Maybe one technology, banks are usually adopting technologies that already have been proven somewhere. So that's a trend that you definitely see a lot. But there's a certain reality, because they're not risk takers. They might love your solution and everybody's jumping on the table that, right, oh, we've never seen something like that. But then again, you're a small startup, so we have a problem. On the other hand, I do think there are certain banks that are willing to invest. I think the larger banks you have, the more complicated it gets. But there's parts in the world, I think, where banks are a bit smaller and they love to adopt new technologies. And as a startup, the key things is always developing partnerships. Distribution of your product is often more important than your product itself.
Right? Yeah, absolutely. So Mircea?
Yeah, I can add here that I've worked with banks that had as a policy that the bank should never use a technology or should never work with a startup if they couldn't find at least another three large banks that are already using that.
Right.
So, and by definition, they are obsolete by strategy. And 5 years later and two CEOs later, they had to change that strategy.
Yeah. Yeah. And this, you know, this traditional approach of, well, let's wait to see the ROI before we commit, you know, for things like smartphones, as an example. Yeah. You know, that's why a lot of banks waited 5 years after the iPhone launch before they did it. They wondered where the ROI was going to be, and then they were significantly behind in terms of engagement.
One thing I wanted to, maybe I can add, though, is that with all these things now, with consumer and the experience and big data, is that after we signed one bank in a certain country, the other four top banks followed within 6 months.
Yeah. That's pretty typical. Okay, so Mircea, what's up next for you?
Oh, so... we keep looking for new companies to invest, but at the same time, I started helping some companies in much more detail. So we started working with you in a much deeper role, and we'll see how Movin can grow to the next level, given the great platform that you have built and the great start. Now let's try to accelerate.
And Luke, where can we find out about NG Data?
You can find it on our website, ndj.com. That's most of the information.
Great. Yeah. All right. Well, thanks for coming into the studio today and sharing us with some of your insights. And Mircea, thanks for joining us on the show today.
My pleasure.
Okay, guys, listen, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be back talking, or we're going to have Jessica Alerm with another interview from Sydney. And don't forget, New York City this September 16 and 17, Finovate is coming. Use the Breaking Banks 20 to get a discount off registration. We'll be right back after this break.
Time. There's never enough. You just don't have the time to search out all the latest banking innovations from around the world. But the good news is, we've already done it for you at Banking Reports. 700 hours of research goes into each edition of our Global Banking Innovation Monitor. Be smarter and get one step ahead. Get Banking Reports sent quarterly to your inbox. To subscribe, follow us on Twitter at banking_reports.
The successful businesses of today do everything they can to meet the needs of their customers. But outdated IT systems mean that banks often struggle to offer the same level of personalized service. SunTech is working with some of the world's leading banks to help them provide the products, offers, and services that their customers need and want. Visit suntechgroup.com to find out more. That's suntechgroup.com.
Today, make that long overdue call to your bank and thank them. Thank them for a checking account, one that has a minimum balance and penalties for going below it. Thank them for a savings account, one that has almost no interest and charges statement fees to let you know it. Most of all, thank them for overdraft fees and all those other fees you never even knew existed. Thank them today. Why? Because the future of banking is here, and it's not just what you want, it's what you deserve. Movin is a free app and debit card with no overdraft, ATM, or monthly fees. Best of all, you get an instant receipt every time you make a purchase, and daily feedback on your spending so you can always be on top of your money. So make that call to your bank and say thanks, but no thanks. And when you're done, download the free app and get Movin today.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Breaking Banks featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag #BreakingBanks. Now, back to the program.
Now, Jessica Alerm, who was on the show a few weeks ago, you remember our correspondent in Sydney this week, had the opportunity to interview Mitchell Haddad, the new chief marketing officer at Society One, a P2P lender. So listen to her interview, and then I'll come back and wrap up the show. Over to you, Jessica.
Thanks, Brett. Today I'm here with Mitchell Herod, the recently appointed Chief Marketing Officer of Australia's first peer-to-peer lender, Society One. Welcome, Mitch.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Fantastic. Now, Mitch, you've got a pretty special pedigree. Can you tell us the company you were at before you landed at Society One?
Sure. So, you know, I'm proud to, prior to joining Society One, I spent the last 4 years running the borrower marketing program at Lending Club in San Francisco.
Okay. And what are some of the highlights of your time at Lending Club?
You know, really, you know, ultimately, it was certainly the results. You know, I joined Lending Club at a very similar point in its lifespan and development to Society One. The company was a few years old. You know, we certainly had some good people and technology in place, had some business that was starting to accelerate, but still quite small and a long way from profitability and from scale, and it looks a lot like what we have at Society One. So during my 4 years at Lending Club, we were doing about $50 million U.S. in loan originations during my first quarter. In the last full quarter I was at the company a few months ago, we did $1.6 billion.
Wow.
And so, you know, that was really some tremendous success that carried through all facets of the business, revenue, headcount, and everything else. And really, probably the pinnacle day was in December of 2014, you know, being on the floor in the New York Stock Exchange when we had the largest IPO of a U.S. company in all of 2014.
That's something you definitely want to add to the resume, no doubt.
Yeah, we're very proud.
Excellent. So how did the guys at Society One land you?
You know, I started, actually I read an article about Society One in a very respected industry publication called Lend Academy, which is written by an Australian living in America, and he really identified Society One as an extraordinarily innovative company in a market where there was no marketplace lender at that point in time. I was impressed first and foremost by what I read about the company and what they were trying to do and who was involved with it. And that sort of led me to pick up the phone and say, you know, I'm very interested in learning more about Australia. And we had a very, very long multi-year conversation about joining the company and moving here. So it's great to finally have that come to fruition.
And how many weeks in are you now?
I'm in week three or four.
And are you making your presence felt already?
Probably, yes.
So you've been described by the AFR as the architect behind Lending Club's exponential growth. What were the building blocks of that particular growth strategy?
Sure. You know, I think architect is probably a little bit of a grandiose term, but certainly, you know, I'm proud to have been a major contributor there. You know, certainly a few keys to success at Lending Club. You know, I think the two I would highlight that really translate the most to Society One and the Australian market. The first is Lending Club thrives and first really burst onto the scene because it offers consumers something better. An easier way to get a loan, a faster way to get a loan, and for most customers, because Lending Club uses risk-based pricing, a much cheaper loan than they could obtain from a traditional bank. And ultimately, when you're lending money, things like relationship and brand and convenience are very important, but price seems to really motivate a lot of decision-making. And Lending Club really thrives because we offer consumers the best price that is generally available to them. Lending Club rewards people for their good credit, much as Society One does. And so that was a very key driver. Offer people a better, cheaper product that's really easy to get. And certainly they did and still do respond extremely well to that. The other big secret to success at Lending Club in terms of marketing was our dedication to really being a multi-channel marketer and really focusing on scale, how to go big. You know, at different points in Lending Club's history, we had strategies and tactics that performed extremely well in terms of acquiring new customers. We remain very focused on how do we keep disciplined on building a portfolio of strategies and tactics. So at some point in time, if one of them begins to falter or lose steam because of regulatory changes or competition or other market factors, we still have a lot of other things to turn to. And really what also drives that is a relentless focus on scale.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I think, is even more important in the Australian market, which obviously with a much smaller population is even more crucial. But focusing on things that can go big.
Great. And just with some of those tactics, what do you think is one of the more out-of-the-box ideas in terms of growth or acquisition tactics that you had at Lending Club?
You know, at Lending Club, really, we were focused on scale. And it's especially in Silicon Valley, every company talks about scale. I think probably the most remarkable thing about my Lending Club experience was we really had to mean it and we really had to understand it. And I think that's a big difference I'm finding in Australia is less of a concept of that. I think most people sort of, you know, the word is used a lot, but understanding here's what it really takes to go big. And so in Lending Club, I think what was probably the most remarkable thing is how many times we would say no. Here are many, many, many opportunities that we would find or put in front of us every single week. And many of them were good ideas that could drive business, But when we look at how do we manage a set of limited resources and how do we move the needle to grow the business, we move the business by saying no to a lot more than we said yes to and focus on things that had the chance to go big and that we could execute well.
And can you give me an example of one of the ones that you would have said yes to that had a material effect on growth?
You know, again, I'd really focus on kind of the multi-channel stuff of there was no magic bullet that makes the Lending Club machine work. It's a whole arsenal, not to be too military, of strategies and tactics where we really deploy them in concert, and they offer a trade-off of, you know, some are more flexible or less flexible, some are more expensive or less expensive, some we can, you know, change very rapidly, and some have a very long lead time. But putting those together to really form an orchestrated strategy that helps Lending Club you know, achieve its remarkable and remarkably consistent results.
Mm-hmm. And so what's your focus now that you're at Society One? What's your immediate focus when it comes to growth and acquisition?
You know, I think we're looking at a few different things, and it's really much like my Lending Club experience. Take it from a startup that has shown some success, has a product that consumers are excited about and eager to buy, and figure out how to do that more efficiently, do it in a more automated way, and again, go back to that scale word, how to make it grow really big. So, you know, it's certainly my second week on the job, a multifaceted focus, but looking at how do we provide a dramatically better online experience than any lender in Australia. And I think the opportunity there is really tremendous. I think the Australian consumer has not necessarily been treated well by financial services here. Doing things is much harder for the consumer than I'm accustomed to seeing in the U.S., and it's often more expensive. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, how do we put something in front of the consumer that dramatically exceeds what their expectations for financial services is?
Sure.
And that's really where most of our efforts are going in the months ahead.
There's a bit of a perception, I suppose, in the market in Australia when it comes to consumer financial products that maybe you're better off staying with your bank for all your financial needs. Mm-hmm. You know, you want to have a good, I suppose you want to look good in the eyes of your bank when it comes to your credit history and so on. Do you perceive that as a challenge for Society One when you're trying to acquire business away from the banks, essentially?
Mm-hmm. You know, I think the main advantage, and it's substantial, that banks in Australia have is their tremendous brand and their tremendous reach. And, you know, we talk about the four banks in Australia. Everyone knows who the four banks are. Everyone knows which of the four banks you are with. And it very well may be, from what I've learned so far, the same bank that your father and his father was with. And so, you know, certainly that relationship and that brand are worth a lot. But, you know, looking at it from the flip side and being a new Australian financial services consumer myself, I think the consumer just gets very different shades of the same flavor. And so all the banks can offer, you know, there's certainly value to brand and relationship, but the consumer, I think, overall has not been given choice, has not been given empowerment, and has not been given the ability to understand what things cost and why, and what they can do, the choices they can make to make things more affordable for them. It's a very different consumer proposition in Australia than the United States. I think, you know, I'm having some of that reverse shock of, again, as a new financial services consumer, you know, I'm newly arrived with a car loan and a bank account and credit cards. How little choice, how little competition, and how much more onerous it is to obtain those products than in the United States. And certainly there's foundational reasons for that. You know, there's different interest rate environment, credit reporting, and everything else in the U.S., and what we're doing at Society One is not trying to replicate the U.S. and Australia, but there are certainly some very big learnings that do translate here. And really, I think the most exciting one is, instead of banks battling over whose brand is the best or the most creative or the most cheeky, we can provide the consumer value. And we can help them save money and make things easier and make it easier for them to achieve their goals. And my experience in America is that they respond extraordinarily well to that.
Sure. Now, when it comes to building out your team here, or, you know, Society One being a fintech player, I suppose, what are the kind of skill sets that you're looking for in a marketing team?
You know, we kind of look for two things. One, you know, as a company-wide, we are in financial services. And so what's challenging, and it was a challenge at Lending Club as well, is we need to find people with deep expertise in different areas of financial services, like credit, like risk management, like investor services. And the truth of the matter is, in the U.S. as in Australia, most of those people are coming from large established banks and other investment companies. And so our challenge here is, how do we find people that, you know, work for a bank with 50, 75, 100,000 employees and have that domain knowledge and expertise, but are eager to go to a much smaller company that's trying to do things in a different, more consumer-friendly way, and are able to execute on that. You know, I interviewed a great candidate yesterday from one of the big four banks for a position, and her current role is managing a team of 60 people. Society One has about 60 employees. And so it's a challenge of finding people that understand the industry, have the skill set, but can pivot from working from giant institutions. And I worked for J.P. Morgan Chase, one of the largest banks in the world, too. So, you know, I understand the very different environment. Finding people that can go from working those large institutions and bringing that expertise to a much smaller one, and being able to operate and thrive in a much more nimble environment. In terms of marketers, it's people who are able to be creative, to understand that everything we do is data-driven. At the end of the day, you know, this is a very funnel-based business. If we drive 1,000 people into our loan application, we need to get a certain number out of them, a certain number of them out the other side and into a brand new loan that they like in order to make the business work. And then our goal is to continuously improve that rate by offering a better and better process and product to those consumers. So for marketers themselves, looking at people who are very data-driven, understand the drivers of the business. And again, I think the very big one I'll come back to yet again is scale. Understanding that we have countless opportunities in front of us, we need to focus on the largest and most promising ones. And so far, I'm thrilled with what I've seen in the workforce here and in Australia.
And when it comes to being nimble, I suppose, and being able to do some tactical things that will kind of throw the banks off or allow you to kind of wiggle your way through, Do you draw inspiration from any other sectors of the startup community? I mean, coming from San Francisco, you must have seen some pretty interesting growth tactics used by startups.
You know, I think really it's, we hear the phrase a lot in marketing right now, very popular one, of kind of surprise and delight. Give the consumer something way better than they were expecting. People don't often, I think especially in Australia, associate that phrase with financial services, but that's what we're out to do here. How can we give consumers a dramatically easier process that is much more transparent and ends with you getting something much better than you thought you were going to get, which in a lot of cases means saving hundreds or thousands of dollars a year on your new loan? And I think that's something that we are very capable of executing on and very quickly.
Any parting words? Big plans for Society One, IPO on the cards potentially?
You know, right now we're just focused on building our business and having some great success with that, and we'll see what the future brings. But, you know, I'm thrilled to be in Australia, and, you know, I think probably my most pleasant surprise is Society One is certainly a company that would fit right in Silicon Valley. And so we'll look to generate that same kind of excitement and success.
Fantastic. Thanks, Mitch.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Jess. All right, so guys, that was the show for this week. Don't forget Cybus InterTribe coming up October 11th, 15th in Singapore. We will be there. Breaking Banks will be there, so make sure you're there. And thanks again to our sponsor, Jumio, who's helped us out. Next week, some exciting stuff planned for you guys. We'll tune in then. And otherwise, have a great weekend. This is Brett King from Breaking Banks signing off from New York. We'll see you guys next week.
Listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, for more of the latest in fintech news.